Welcome to Emil Franzink's Voices of the West, dedicated to the principle that America was better off when our TV shows featured cowboys instead of lawyers.
And you know that to be true, and we got a special one for you today. Shows better when they featured U.S. Marshals than lawyers.
Real McCoy.
Yeah. Dave Kennedy is our guest. We'll get to him in just a minute. He's with the United States Marshals Museum at Fort Smith, Arkansas. Before we get to that, I'm Harry Alexander, Bunker to France across the way in Los Angeles. Our good friend Todd Roberts.
Hello, gentlemen.
Howdy.
Hello.
And before we get going on, we got Bunker's Bunkhouse, right?
Yes, we do. Coming to you from Bunker's Bunkhouse is the good, the bad, and the bovine. Now, for David's sake, I'm going to explain this. And unfortunately, as a historian, he's probably going to cringe all through this. But what I do is I start with today.
He'll set you right.
I'm going to start with today, which is the 13th of June. And I'm going to travel back 3 days in time and travel 3 days forward in time. But the 3 days forward in time will be in the past.
Okay.
And I know that makes a lot of sense.
Uh-huh.
But we're going to start with June 10, 1692, with the Salem Witch Trials, a series of hearings and prosecutions. Bridget Bishop, a midwife, was the first person executed for witchcraft. She was hanged at Gallows Hill near Salem, Massachusetts, for certain detestable arts called witchcraft and sorcery. Now, moving on, it was June 11, 1776. That's also part of our 250th anniversary. The Continental Congress appoints Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Roger Sherman, and Robert R. Livingston to a committee of five to draft and present to the Congress a Declaration of Independence.
It turned out to be a committee of one.
Well, he did all the work. Well, him and Adams did a lot of work.
Jefferson.
Yeah. I know, he did all the big work, but Adams helped a bunch. And, these guys, at least they got into history book.
So, there you go.
That's all. It's got important. You got to get in the book. You know, because guys like me years later will mention your names. Now, on June 12, 1665, Thomas Willett, a Plymouth Colony trader, merchant, land purchaser, development, captain of the Plymouth Colony militia, is appointed the first mayor of New York prior to the consolidation of the five boroughs into New York City. Now, today, the 13th of June, but in 1740, province of Georgia, governor and lieutenant general in the army, James Oglethorpe, he begins a unsuccessful attempt to take Spanish Florida for the first major land claim. Ooh, I'm screwing this up. I'm going to back up. Thank you. That helped. He started the unsuccessful first attempt to take Spanish Florida from the first major land claim, which was the Spanish in North America. During the siege of St. Augustine, a part of the much larger conflict known as the War of Jenkins' Ear. Mm-hmm. And that's funny, that war was fought because somebody cut off Jenkins' ear.
Bummer.
Bummer. They went to Congress for that. Anyhow, June 14, 1777.
That print's getting awful close to the paper, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, my handwriting. Anyhow, on this day in the 14th in 1777, was the first Flag Day. It commemorates the Continental Congress adoption of the Stars and Stripes as the official American flag. Also, and this is very important for you and Todd, this is also National Bourbon Day, a celebration of America's native spirit defined by Congress as a distinctive product of the United States.
And we shall be celebrating, right,
yes,
Todd?
Indeed.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
This is for you, Todd. Okay, now, on the 15th of June in 1607, Virginia colonists, that's the colonists, that's the folks, finished building James Fort in Jamestown. It was the first permanent English settlement on the northeast bank of the James River. It was built to defend against Spanish and Indian attacks. Because you know how those fellas were. They didn't like these newcomers coming around.
Right.
And I will finish up with June 16, 1858. I like this one. Abraham Lincoln delivers his famous House Divided speech while accepting the Illinois Republican Party's nomination for the United States Senate, stating, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." And gentlemen, that's so true today as well.
You forgot a very important item that happened on June 14th as well.
Did I forget it? Or
no, you didn't mention it, so I assume you forgot it.
I probably did.
Okay.
What is it? Tell me. I'm waiting.
The birth of the United States Army. Hoorah!
Hoorah. No, that's not as important as the birth of the United States Navy.
Yeah, okay.
Did we have a Navy first?
No, we had the Army first, and then the Marines. Imagine that.
And then the Marshall Service.
Speaking of Marshall Service, let's get our guest on the horn here. It's David Kennedy from Fort Smith, Arkansas. He's with the United States Marshals Museum. David, thank you much for joining us this afternoon. Real pleasure.
Thank you, gentlemen, for having me on.
Let's talk about the museum. Earlier, before we went to the live stream, we talked about who's in charge of the place. And basically, you are just a good old nonprofit, right?
We are a nonprofit. There's a lot of folks out there who think that we're part of the government, we're part of the Marshal Service, but that's couldn't be further from the truth. We are a private nonprofit. We're a 501c3, so a tax-exempt organization. We receive no federal funding, and almost everything that we have ever done has come from private donors, most of it within about a 45-minute hour drive of where I'm currently sitting at the building. Nice. And we are one of America's newest museums. This July 1st, we are going to be celebrating our third anniversary being open to the public.
Wow.
And this is a museum that, as its own, was about nearly 15 years in the making.
Wow.
Just between getting the ideas together, getting the funding together.
Sure.
It's not cheap building the building, much less.
Yeah.
Much less starting up a museum, and we are here to tell the story of, it's not America's oldest law enforcement, it's America's first law enforcement.
Uh-huh. All right. And the website is marshalsmuseum.org. Go check it out, folks. Great photography there. The building itself is, like, really impressive.
Now, looking here, it seems like you're the jack of all trades there. You're curator, technologist, social media manager, exhibit planner, presenter, and primary point of contact, which is what we're doing now.
And I think there's a few of those that actually fall on other people. There was a few years ago where that was, like, very much what I was part of when we had a smaller staff. Once we opened up and staffed up, there were a number of those jobs that kind of, like, social media went over to somebody else, point of contact things, communications, things like that go to other folks. My job currently, I am the curator of collections and exhibits, which means I'm responsible for the stuff and I am responsible for the knowledge about what we take in and what we try to educate other folks about. Mm-hmm. And so, I know you were joking earlier as he was listing out all the stuff within this last week of history, and somebody had commented that I might, as a historian, might take an issue with that. There's a reason why some of the folks here on staff, one of the nicknames that they've thrown over to me is I'm the crusher of dreams. We get a lot of people who show up who have this deep family story about how great-great-grandpa Johnny was a U.S. Marshal here under Parker and went out and captured all these bad guys. And then you go and you start doing research and you find out that, well, no, he was living in Kansas and working on a beet farm or something. I mean, it's just there's about half of the people who contact us, they are legitimate, they have real stories.
Yeah.
But then we've had at least two or three different times people showing up claiming to be descendants of Rooster Cogburn.
Mm. Okay. Todd Roberts.
Yeah.
We got to walk him back from that sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, that's got to me. It's got to be one of the fun parts, though, is accessing artifacts and the stories and stuff.
Sure.
You know, you get to you get to hear it's all these things firsthand for the first time.
Todd, jump in there.
So, David, I not to bring up something negative, but would you please touch on the Going Snake incident?
Going Snake incident, I would be more than happy to, and I don't really even look at it as being a negative. It tells what we've been able to do here really shines a light on the job the marshals have, as well as how difficult that job was here in this region. For much of the history of this region being Arkansas and Oklahoma, the marshals were the law in what's now Oklahoma. Indian Territory being the eastern, most of the eastern half of the state, where the five tribes, the Cherokee, Choctaw, Muscogee, Creek, the Chickasaw, and the Seminole were given land when they were forcibly removed from the southeast. And then you have what later became Oklahoma Territory to the west of that. And for much of that time, the marshals operating out of either Van Buren or after the Civil War, they moved to Fort Smith. They were responsible for enforcing federal law in the Indian Territory. And by federal law, that was anything that involved a U.S. citizen that was either, if the U.S. citizen either committed a crime or was the victim of a crime, or if there was any sort of importation of liquor or other spirituous liquids into Indian Territory, that wasn't allowed. And so really, honestly, during the 1800s, here in this part of the area, two-thirds of the people charged with crime in Indian Territory were charged for crimes involving alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the biggest part of it. And so, but beyond that, if there was a crime involving a U.S. citizen, that would be a federal charge. A lot of people don't really understand that the Indian nations had their own law enforcement. They had their own laws. They had their own courts. And so if I was a Cherokee citizen and I committed a crime against another Cherokee citizen, I would be arrested and tried in a Cherokee court. And so there's there was an incident that takes place at a mill, grain mill, about 2 hours north-northwest from us. 2 hours today as you would drive, and a guy named Zeke Proctor shows up with a complaint about Jim Kesterson, who's a U.S. citizen there, who's married to a woman named Polly Beck, who owns the mill. And Zeke shows up. We're not sure what the complaint was, but we think he was angry at Kesterson for abandoning Proctor's sister and his three nieces. Kesterson had been married to her for a while. And so he shows up, words are spoken, one thing leads to another. We know that a couple of shots were fired. One of those, at least, was at Kesterson. The other one, Polly Beck, either like jumped in front of the gun or just, it's a gunfight, bad things happen. And so Polly Beck is shot and killed. Zeke realizes what he did. He's a Cherokee citizen. Polly is a Cherokee citizen. Zeke goes and turns himself into the sheriff in that district and tells him what happened, and okay, so we're going to start up the court case. The behind the scenes of this was that the Beck family and the Proctor family for years had been at loggerheads. Mm. Ever since they were in the southeastern United States, and they were having issues then. They had issues like which side agreed with the treaty that removed them to what's now Oklahoma. They were on different sides of the American Civil War. They were on different sides of what direction they thought the Cherokee Nation should go in. Zeke was very much more traditional Cherokee. The Beck family was very much wanting to be more progressive, wanting to take on more change as they were seeing in the rest of the United States. And so with all of these problems, and with how popular Zeke was, the Beck family did not believe that Zeke was going to see justice, which they meant by hanging at the end of a very long rope. And so they kept trying to do everything they could to change the outcome of this trial. They knew Zeke was going to become, was going to be acquitted and was going to get off for the crime of killing their cousin and, in some cases, sibling, Polly Beck. And so they are doing this trial. And eventually, the Beck family realizes, okay, we're going to have to play our ace in the hole. A few of the Beck, male Beck family members grab Jim Kesterson. They ride down to Fort Smith, and they swear out a warrant for assault against a United States citizen. And by doing that, all of a sudden, they bring in the jurisdiction of the United States court at Fort Smith. The court at Fort Smith, they know what's going on. They know that it's just a fire just waiting to happen. And so they get a sizable posse where normally, if they were going out to get somebody, they would send a deputy with a posse man, and that would be about it to go and make some arrests. In this case, they send two deputy U.S. Marshals, eight of their normal posse, as well as mixed in a couple of folks they knew really well who they hired on the spot. And then, by the way, they sent along five members of the Beck family were riding along with them. And the way I tried to explain this to some folks is imagining if you are modern law enforcement today and you're going to go serve a warrant on somebody who you know shot and killed somebody in the middle of a neighborhood where they've got a lot of friends. And, oh, by the way, you're going to take several armed members of the deceased's family with you. To arrest the person.
Sure thing.
That's what they're riding into. And the whole time they're going there, the deputy in charge is trying to explain to the Beck family members with them, look, when we go there, we don't want any trouble. We just want to go and wait till the end of the court case. If Zeke is convicted, we're just going to step back, let Cherokee Nation take care of it. If Zeke is acquitted, we'll take him into custody, take him back to Fort Smith. That lasted about as long as it took to get inside the door of the one-room schoolhouse where the court was being held.
Oh boy.
As soon as they step in, one of the Beck family members lowers his side-by-side shotgun, fires the first barrel, which a guard next to the door pushed the barrel down into the floor. Barrel comes back up. By some accounts, that second barrel hits and kills Zeke Proctor's brother. Over the next 5 minutes, you have as many as 50 people involved in a gunfight. So this becomes what I personally and what the museum considers to be the biggest, bloodiest gunfight in American history.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
Outside of anything the military was involved
sure.
in.
Yeah.
And so you have Beck's firing against Proctor's, Proctor's shooting at Beck's. You've got the two deputies and their eight posse in the middle of all of this. And by the time everything is all said and done between the two sides, there's 11 men dead, 11 men wounded. Well, I should say dead or mortally wounded. Another 11 who are wounded outright. And of those, eight of the dead and dying are from the Marshal's posse, including the deputy who's in charge, and jeez, including four members of the Beck family who are riding along with them.
Wow.
On the Cherokee side, you have already mentioned that Zeke's brother is killed. Zeke's defense attorney is killed. Zeke himself is injured. Judge Blackhaw, Sixth Killer, is injured. The jury foreman is injured. And because there's Cherokee on both sides, this is the biggest incident of Cherokee on Cherokee crime in one place that we know of, at least in what's now Oklahoma. I'm sure they had other instances when they were still back east. But the gunfight's over probably within 5 or so minutes. And the surviving posse members are running to Arkansas as fast as they can go.
Mm-hmm.
They're only 5 or 6 miles inside the inside Indian territory.
Uh-huh.
As soon as they can, they telegraph down to Fort Smith what just happened. Fort Smith immediately sends a posse of 20 or 30 deputies and posse men to run up and try and arrest anybody involved with this. The Cherokee Nation puts out warrants for all of the members of the Marshal's posse. And so for about the next year and a half, Cherokee Nation and the United States are not wanting to deal with each other. Deputies aren't really riding up into that area to pursue any warrants. And eventually President Grant brings in his U.S. Attorney General. He brings in the Secretary of State, brings in Indian Affairs, and tells them all, send news to the Cherokee that if they are willing to clear all of their warrants, we will clear all of our warrants. And that's exactly what happens. Mm. And so eventually, after this huge case, and eight people who went there on the orders of the Office of U.S. Marshals, eight of them are killed, and there's no charges against anybody for any of this, but they end up essentially making peace with the Cherokee Nation.
Wow.
And one of the really crazy things about all of this is Zeke Proctor, the guy who was the defendant, he was armed in the courtroom. His Spencer rifle, well, Spencer carbine was behind him, leaned up against the wall. We have a written account from one of the survivors of the posse saying, like, telling that just as he got into the tree line, he turned to look back towards the school, and he saw Zeke step out of the one-room schoolhouse with his Spencer, and he lowered his Spencer at him, fired, and he heard the shot go past him.
Wow.
And so this is a defendant in a murder case, had his rifle there in the room. And 20 years after this incident, Zeke Proctor is named as the Deputy United States Marshal in the Northern District of Indian Territory.
You know, I want to...
Hang on. Hell of a history, and we got to do our first commercial break here before we get going on anything else. Hell of a history. David Kennedy is our guest. He's with the U.S. Marshals Museum. Marshalsmuseum.org is the website. Do check it out. It's really cool. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, and Todd Roberts back with you right after these important messages. Stay tuned.
Arizona, the land of cattle, copper, and cowboys. It's also the true West, where a large number of Westerns were filmed. For your next vacation, come out to where Wyatt Earp made a name for himself as a highly respected sheriff. Stay where Jimmy Stewart filmed Winchester 73.
That would be the White Stallion Ranch. Situated in the mountains just northwest of Tucson, the White Stallion Ranch is an award-winning dude ranch with 43 guest rooms and the Hacienda. That's a five-bedroom, three-bathroom home, perfect for larger families, family reunions, and girlfriend getaways. Every guest room has a private patio with views of the cactus gardens, mountains, or corrals. Generous floor plans offer sunny, comfortable rooms, but you won't want to stay in your room. Outdoor activities are plentiful at the White Stallion Ranch. Horseback riding, hiking, shooting, archery, rock climbing, e-biking, and a weekly ranch rodeo are among the numerous activities that you'll enjoy on your ranch vacation. Go Western for your next getaway. The White Stallion Ranch. Book your vacation now online at whitestallionranch.com or call 520-297-0252.
This is Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management. If you're within 10 to 15 years of retirement and you're putting off retirement planning, my advice to you is don't do that. Ignoring your retirement planning won't make it go away. It'll just make it worse. Give me a call and let's work on your plan together so you can retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
The Tucson Trap and Ski Club is one of the best-kept economic secrets in town. This 900-member group maintains one of the finest shotgun shooting ranges in the country, featuring trap, skeet, five-stand, and sporting clays fields, and hosts national and international events that bring thousands of people and millions of dollars into our community. The Spring Satellite Grand American Tournament alone involves 1,200 participants for 10 days. Learn more about this and their other contributions to our community at TucsonTrapAndSkeet.com.
I wonder what old Marshal Gregg would say if someone told him we saved his life today. The old buzzard didn't know that hombre was on the roof right above him.
If we hadn't winged him, the Marshal had been wearing wings by now.
Or horns. You never can tell.
This is the Voices of the West.
Cowboy band. He plays the best bass in the land. He plays it on that North Tribune.
speed. He plays it hard and he plays it sweet. He plays the full pedal boogie. He goes to town with the solid beat. That's a real low down.
We are back on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France. Todd Roberts in Los Angeles, our guest. David Kennedy out of Fort Smith, Arkansas. And he's talking to us from the United States Marshals Museum. And check it out. Marshalsmuseum.org is their website.
And I got a follow-up on what he just told us about Going Snake.
Okay.
If you go to the Marshals, their site, website, they had a Going Snake at 150. It was a seminar, and I watched it. It's around almost 2 hours. It gives a history of the Cherokee Marshal Service, but then they have a historian that goes over the same ground that David just did. And I'll guarantee you, I spent, when I should have been working on research, I spent a few hours watching this video. It was worth it.
Slacker, you're going to get docked on your pay, man.
Oh, yeah. No, it was worth it. I learned so much.
We were, that was one of the things we were very, very proud of being able to do, was have that program here at the museum. That was not even a year before we opened to the general public. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was just over a year before we opened to the general public. We were in the middle of creating all of our exhibits that were going to be here when we opened in July of 2023. And so we're working with our exhibits company. It was actually out in Los Angeles. They do mostly what's called themed entertainment, Disneyland, Universal Studios, things like that. But a lot of these companies do things like museums and other educational locations that have a theme or have an idea. And so we're working through these ideas to help create our museum. And the research that I was doing here at the museum, specifically into this subject, but into some other subjects, we were able to put some attention into these subjects that had not been given, at least from an academic standpoint, for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And the general story about Going Snake for the last, really, 100 years was that these awful marshals went rolling into Cherokee Nation and they got punished for trying to tell the Cherokee how to live their lives. Mm. It was as if the Cherokee came and just completely inserted themselves into this problem, and then Zeke Proctor came out of it, I think in many ways rightly a hero, but they felt that Zeke Proctor came out of it as a hero, and for many years people believed that Zeke was the only individual in our country's history to have ever signed a peace treaty with the American government. And our research into this made us finally realize that no, it wasn't that the marshals went in where they weren't supposed to be at, and they weren't trying to ride roughshod over anyone. It was that they were doing the mission that they were given, which was to go and bring an individual, a fugitive, to justice, and that they were being brought in by the machinations of one faction within a war between two different groups within the Cherokee Nation. And so, like a lot of people, I just explained to them, okay, they were the Hatfield and McCoy of the Cherokee Nation. Hmm. And the Beck family brought in the marshals as a hammer, and they were seeing Zeke Proctor as the nail. And as a result of that, the marshals came in to a situation, as they had to preserve order, to continue their mission. But they ended up being punished in some lights. They ended up just essentially, they showed up within a fight that two other groups were having, and they ended up suffering as a result of it. That's why we try to refer to it more as the tragedy at Going mm-hmm. Snake mm-hmm. rather than what some people have referred to as the Going Snake Massacre. Mm-hmm.
That's what the speaker referred to it as a tragedy.
Let's talk.
Yeah,
go ahead.
And so that I was about to say that as a result of all of this research, we were not a year and a half out from opening up as a museum, and we were, as a result of some of the revelations that we came across, that we were still actively changing and rewriting and forcing other people to change and rewrite the exhibits that they were trying to finish up the design of.
Hmm. Let's talk about the establishment of the United States Marshals Service. Obviously, we had town sheriffs, we had town marshals, we had constables, and whatever other title they could wrangle up. The first United States Marshal was who?
There were 13 of them.
Okay.
The first 13 U.S. Marshals, they were all appointed on September 24th, September 25th of 1789. They were all appointed by President George Washington. And so it's one of those things that this year, as everyone's talking about the 250th birthday of our country, I keep trying to sit there and think, okay, is it the 250th birthday of the idea of our country?
Yeah.
Because it wasn't until 1789 that the Constitution finally came into play and that the Congress met for the very first time that spring of 1789, that the country, the United States of America, with all is one term, not United States, which happened to be in America,
right,
is we were all working together. The very first thing that happened was because of the failures of the Articles of Confederation that we'd ran under for the previous 10 or 13 years. The Articles of Confederation, the judiciary had no teeth. If you lived in one state, you couldn't really sue somebody in another state. If you committed a crime in one place, in one state, and you fled to a second state, that second state didn't really have to force you to go back. And so under the Constitution, they knew they needed to have, for that of that third pillar of our government, the judiciary, they knew they needed to have some teeth. And so the very first thing that the Senate did as soon as they met and had quorum the first time is they created a committee to go off and create this new judiciary. Because if you look at Article 3 of the Constitution, it says, here's the Supreme Court, this is what they do, and we're going to let the Senate figure out, Congress is going to figure out everything else that happens. And so Congress goes away with this committee. They come back and they had this idea to create what we now know of as our district courts. Here, I live in the Western District of Arkansas. I go across the river and I'll be in the Eastern District of Oklahoma. If you're in Arizona, you're in the District of Arizona. There's four different districts in California. I'm not going to even guess where you happen to be living and which one of those lines you're on.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's every district in this plan would have they would have a presidentially appointed judge who's a lifetime appointment. That's the currently a federal district judge. And they would have two other presidentially appointed officers that would serve for a four-year period, the U.S. Attorney and the United States Marshal. The president appoints them, and they are confirmed by the Senate. I think of the Office of Marshal as the most apolitical political office that you can have. You have to have a political backbone and a political demeanor to be able to get the job. You have to come to the attention of your U.S. senators and the president, and they have to want to appoint you to this job. But then once you are confirmed and in that job, party and president and politics play nothing to do with your job. Everything you do is for the United States Federal Court and for orders that come down from the judge, whether it is to just issue a warrant, issue a notice to appear, a subpoena for a witness, a federal jury, whether a grand jury or petty jury, to get the notice to be a member of that jury. If they come to seize, if you are a criminal and you went out and with your money from your crimes, went out and bought, like a boat and a sports car and a house, they will come and they will seize your boat, sports car, and house. And then they'll turn around and sell them at auction.
Mm-hmm.
And that is essentially the job that the marshals have had ever since 1724 when it was signed, when the Judiciary Act was signed into law. I'm sorry, 1789, September 24th of that year. And so Washington appoints the first 13 marshals. Over the next couple of years, he appoints three more as Delaware and Vermont and North Carolina all ratify the Constitution. And then so with those 16, we continue on our merry way, and we are still at the backside of that today with 94 federal court districts, several of them being in, again, just as 150 years ago, several are in U.S. territories, whether out in the Pacific or the U.S. Virgin Islands. Puerto Rico is a territory, but it's treated a little bit more like a state for the Marshal's purpose. There's four foreign offices in different countries in Central and South America and the Caribbean that are there permanently to help us coordinate fugitive hunting with those other countries, because they don't want our bad guys there. We don't want their bad guys here. We all want to make sure that we punish everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I say we a lot, but none of the people who are here at the museum have been or are part of the United States Marshal Service. Just we're just really, really excited to be able to share these stories,
sure.
to be able to explain mm-hmm. them to people, and just looking at the history of the country and the role that the Marshals played. I've said on many different occasions that nothing in the way of an important event has ever occurred in our country that the Marshals were not at least somewhere nearby.
Yeah, yeah.
They were involved someplace.
Okay. All right, we're going to do another commercial break here on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of those famous U.S. Marshals.
Oh, well, good. I got one.
And there's bunches of them out there. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts with you. It's Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Dave Kennedy, our guest. Be back.
Can you even imagine switching back to pen and paper to run your business? Every year, we become more and more dependent upon our technology. If your network is not set up properly, you're just one click or one email away from losing data critical to your operation. Arizona Computer Guru offers a host of services to prevent and protect you from disaster. From online backup services to email filtering to fully managed network services, Arizona Computer Guru is here to keep your network secure, your data safe, and your budget in the black. To schedule your free consultation, call 304-8300.
This is Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management. If you're within 10 to 15 years of retirement and you're putting off retirement planning, my advice to you is don't do that. Ignoring your retirement planning won't make it go away. It'll just make it worse. Give me a call and let's work on your plan together so you can retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
The Tucson Trap and Ski Club dates from 1948 and is now at 7800 West Old Ajo Highway. The club owns 80 acres and leases 300 more from Pima County that supports 50 trap fields, 15 skeet fields, 2 5-stand fields, 2 sporting plays courses with 12 stations each, a 9,000-square-foot clubhouse, 200 full-service RV hookups for members, and free Wi-Fi. This expansive facility gives enough room to host major national and international events annually, bringing thousands of people to the community. Check it out at TucsonTrapAndSki.com.
Ain't you just a little bit out of your territory here, Marshal?
I take my territory with me, and right now you're in it.
This is the Voices of the West.
Back on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker de France, Todd Roberts in Los Angeles. Dave Kennedy is our guest. He's with the U.S. Marshals Museum. Marshalsmuseum.org is the website. And Dave, is Matt Dillon correct there? He takes his territory with him?
I love that quote, and it really honestly is true for real marshals.
Okay.
But unfortunately, there's never been a U.S. Marshal assigned to Dodge City, despite the number of Ford County, Kansas Marshals badges I've seen.
Oh, wait a second.
Then he would have been a deputy marshal anyway.
Wasn't Wyatt Earp a deputy U.S. Marshal?
Wyatt Earp was a deputy U.S. Marshal for a hot minute down in Arizona.
That's it,
but,
huh?
But for the question about Dodge City, he would have been really legitimately, he would have been like the city marshal.
Okay.
But he would have been cross-deputized as a deputy United States Marshal.
Okay.
Right.
But which happened all over the West. That's,
okay.
Virgil Earp was city marshal for Tombstone,
yep.
But he was also cross-deputized as a deputy United States marshal, simply so the marshal in the territory of Arizona,
mm-hmm.
if somebody was down there that he needed or I need to have somebody go deliver paper for the court. I need to go have somebody do something on behalf of the court. He could telegraph that information down to Virgil. Virgil could go out and do it and have the full authority of kind of what today would be considered kind of a special deputy U.S. Marshal.
Uh-huh.
It was even at that time considered a special deputy in some cases, where you have the full authority of the federal court if you're doing the federal court business.
Sure. All right, now.
So we go ahead, before we talk about marshals, we have to, Dave, you were telling me about how it is an unfair title to say that Judge Isaac Parker was the hanging judge.
Yeah.
Go into that for us, please, Dave.
That's one of the things, because we typically end up having to talk about Isaac Parker simply because of the relationship. It's part of why we're in Fort Smith, is that time frame, and why Fort Smith is sacred ground. It's that time period of when Isaac Parker was the judge here. And this is, like we were talking about Going Snake earlier, there were some other things going on at that time, which is what led to all kinds of craziness that led to Isaac Parker coming in and really cleaning house here in Fort Smith and doing an amazing job for the 21 years he was on the bench. And during that time frame, when he was here on the bench, one of the things that he ended up being nicknamed the Hanging Judge because of the number of people who he sent to the gallows. And I, like, we can't lie. We can't, like, there, you can't really say anything different about that, because we know that there were 79 people that ended up at the end of a rope because of a decision made at the bench by Isaac Parker. This is a man who was opposed to the death sentence. He didn't agree with that type of punishment, but he also believed that he had a hard job to do, and this is the law. This is what I have to enforce.
Hmm.
And so if somebody committed murder or rape or another crime that was given a mandatory death sentence, he issued that death sentence. And so 79 people who he sentenced to death, and then another 9 sentenced by the 2 or 3 judges prior to him here in this district. And during that time frame, all but one of those death sentences was passed on someone who had committed a crime in Indian Territory. The only one that was not committed in Indian Territory was Cherokee Bill, who killed a man in the federal court jail here in Fort Smith. He was already being held over. He was on appeal for another death sentence, but as a result of an escape attempt that he made when he killed one of the jailers, they tried him real quick and they sentenced him real quick, and he ended up paying for that crime
real quick.
But he's the only person who was sentenced for a crime in what's now Arkansas. And of anybody else, like, it wasn't that there was nobody committing murder, nobody committing rape, nobody committing any other capital crime in Arkansas. It was that if you committed one of those crimes anywhere in the country at the time, you would be tried by city, county, state law enforcement in the judiciary of that organization.
Right.
And so Isaac Parker, the reason why he had to sentence so many people to death is because of the jurisdictional situation that he was in.
Mm-hmm.
If it involved a U.S. citizen, whether it is the criminal or the victim, that was what the crime was, and that was where the jurisdiction went. The only, and just so of that time, if you look at the numbers, the number of people who were sentenced to death and those sentences were carried out in either Van Buren or Fort Smith, that is 1/3 of the total number of death sentences passed by the federal government since the founding of our country.
Hmm.
And so Arkansas holds the largest number of death sentences carried out in the history of our country. A lot of people would never imagine that number 2 on that list is Massachusetts. And again, it comes down to the jurisdiction.
Sure.
For a very long time, if you committed piracy or murder or rape, yep, on the high seas,
yep,
and you were picked up and they got you into Boston, guess where you were going to be tried?
Yipper.
And so, yeah, and so the Boston, New York, California, for those, during the entire time Parker was on the bench and convicting people for those crimes, there were other people who were sentenced to death around the country, but they were all either for piracy or they were people who had committed crimes on federal reservations in some of the different territories to the north, like the Dakotas. And so it was just very much a product of where he was and the rules in place at the time.
Let's talk about Marshal Sam Bass. Let's talk about him. There's been bunches of movies and television
and
programs.
He was not the source.
Are
for
you
the
talking
long
Sam Bass or Bass Reeves?
Bass Reeves.
That's why I was because Sam Bass was a real guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like that kind of came out of left field, and I realized
he was a bad guy.
But he also Sam Bass wore a star for a little bit, but
senior moment.
Hey, we all get those, and I may not look like a senior, but I'm getting there fast enough, especially the way my kids are going.
It's the pressure.
So yes, it is. For Bass Reeves is one of the people I actively research. As a matter of fact, I'll be over in Muskogee, Oklahoma here in a couple of weeks talking about Bass Reeves. They have an annual Bass Reeves history conference that's in Muskogee, Oklahoma at the Three Rivers Museum. If anybody is ever around this part of the country in the back half of June, if you're interested, I would highly recommend that they head out there.
Cool.
But Bass Reeves, really, it's just one of those things that I cannot stop talking about how amazed I am at what he did, especially with his origin story of being an enslaved person, going from that to being, during his lifetime, one of the most feared and respected lawmen in the region. Hmm. And then his story being essentially disappeared for more than half a century. After he passes away in 1910, there's almost no references to him anywhere in any publication, news or books or anything, until finally a couple of different historians start to mention him and research him and some of the other black deputies who were here at the time. His name starts to finally show up again, starting in a little bit in the 60s and a little bit more in the 70s and more in the 80s and finally in the 90s.
Yeah.
Art Burton comes out with a lot more research and eventually publishes Black Gun Silver Star, which I would, if anybody wants to learn more about Bass Reeves, I would definitely recommend that is where you start.
Okay. Good. All right.
But I also blame that book, though. You'd started to mention The Lone Ranger. I blame that book for the many stories about The Lone Ranger. In Arndt's book, he starts out with a few things like, well, we think this. Well, we know sort of this. We believe this is true. And so as a result of all of these different points, Bass Reeves is the closest individual we can find to somebody who fits the idea of the Lone Ranger.
You know, that's interesting there. Fran Stryker, who created the Lone Ranger, was asked where his source was, and he said, I made it up.
And there's some very good research that's been done. I can't remember the individual's name. He researches pop culture and radio and early TV, and he has done some really good academic work as to the source of the character of the Lone Ranger and the Lone Ranger radio show. The problem with what Art had said is that a number of people took what he said and said, oh, he said that Bass is the Lone Ranger.
Gospel.
And so, right. And then so that turned into Facebook memes.
Sure.
And so that ended up kind of entering into the public consciousness. And that, again, goes back to what one of the things I have to deal with, which, if nothing else, ended up, I am about a third of the way through writing my own book about Bass Reeves.
Oh.
And if I can just get past my ADHD and get that done. But
Chapter 2.
Bass really, it was amazing. And when you start looking at who he was and what he did, and it's just a shame. He's been turned into this black and white character of like almost like Superman. I think even the True West magazine cover with him with the Lone Ranger mask. Mm-hmm. I would love to see somebody do Bass Reeves as Superman, just simply because that's kind of what he's been turned into.
Yeah,
but not one
where. But there's so many different little stories that have come up that, like, for example, there was the TV series on Paramount that was out a few years ago.
Yeah.
That about a third of it, I'm thinking, okay, this is really good. This is really telling some good stories about Bass, about the Marshals, about Fort Smith, all this different stuff. Granted, they still cast Isaac Parker to look like Colonel Sanders, but when he showed up here, when he showed up in Fort Smith, he was in his late 30s. He had dark hair, and I mean, it was really just a young guy. And then he wasn't even 60 when he passed away. It was just the stress, and he had some diseases and things like that going on that led to the white hair, and he just did not look healthy at the end of his life. But with some of the ways that about a third of that series, I had questions as to, like, why did they cast that way for these different people? Why did they tell these stories? Why didn't they include these characters? And then about a third of it, I had no idea what they were doing with the storytelling. But you also have to remember, this is television.
Hollywood.
It's entertainment with a big E.
Yep.
They have to tell entertainment. There was a fictionalized account based on a fictionalized account based on a kind of a semi-fictional history.
He said, she said. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so one of the things that I get to do here, and I kind of have to do as part of my responsibility as a historian for the Marshals Museum, is I cannot go out and say, Bass Reeves did whatever is fact, when we know that we have no proof about certain things. We have, and so I need to have the proof. I need to find it. And so I've made some people very, very angry, especially if they've contacted me believing that Bass was their ancestor.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the work I've had to do into Bass, I've gone and pursued through as much of as I can find of his family tree. And it's about that point where about every 4 to 6 months, I kind of dive back into it for a few weeks just to see if there's more stuff that's percolated up. And it's unfortunate that I do not believe that Bass Reeves has any living descendants today who have a trace back to Bass, or who'd know. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of possibilities. There's a couple of, like, kids that literally disappeared into the wilderness. But we know of his sister Jane had some kids. And so we know of some of the descendants of Jane's family. One of them ended up being Judge Paul Brady, one of the first black federal court judges in the United States. He's still alive and well and living in the Atlanta area. There's some descendants from Jane who are living in the area around Muskogee and this part of the country, but they don't have any of the real direct ties that we would hope for. Just knowing who these people are and trying to find them, knowing that Bass was this, seen as this icon of law, that of his kids, everybody very famously knows about Benny going and killing his wife in a fit of passion, and then turning him in. That's one of the unfortunate stories, is instead of him running into the wilderness to run away from the law, he killed his wife, realized what he did, and then walked himself over to his dad's house and turned himself in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a much more boring story, but sometimes history is that way.
Yeah. All right, we got to finish up our commercial break here. Way over.
Yeah.
Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, and Todd Roberts with you. It's Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Dave Kennedy, our guest from the U.S. Marshals Museum. We'll be back.
Arizona, the land of cattle, copper, and cowboys. It's also the true West, where a large number of Westerns were filmed. For your next vacation, come out to where Wyatt Earp made a name for himself as a highly respected sheriff. Stay where Jimmy Stewart filmed Winchester 73.
That would be the White Stallion Ranch. Situated in the mountains just northwest of Tucson, the White Stallion Ranch is an award-winning dude ranch with 43 guest rooms and the Hacienda, That's a 5-bedroom, 3-bathroom home, perfect for larger families, family reunions, and girlfriend getaways. Every guest room has a private patio with views of the cactus gardens, mountains, or corrals. Generous floor plans offer sunny, comfortable rooms, but you won't want to stay in your room. Outdoor activities are plentiful at the White Stallion Ranch. Horseback riding, hiking, shooting, archery, rock climbing, e-biking, and a weekly ranch rodeo are among the numerous activities that you'll enjoy on your ranch vacation. Go Western for your next getaway. The White Stallion Ranch. Book your vacation now online at whitestallionranch.com or call 520-297-0252.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
No doubt you've heard about rescue groups for dogs and cats, but did you know there's a rescue group for horses? That's right, it's called Horse It Around Rescue. Founders Steve Boyce and Teresa Worrell are helping out all those equine victims of neglect and cruelty by giving them a place to restore their health and wellness. And Horse It Around provides a nurturing and natural environment where horses can be horses, so they can be adopted out into forever homes. More than 120 horses, mules, and donkeys have been adopted out, but like everything else, it costs money to run the project. Horse It Around is a 501c3 nonprofit located in Southeast Arizona. Your tax-deductible donations to Horse It Around will go a long way so those horses can be horses. Check out the website, horseitaroundrescue.org. Make a difference in a horse's life. That's horseitaroundrescue.org.
Besides bringing millions a year into this community with national and international events, the Tucson Trap and Skeet Club at 7800 West Old Ajo Highway services the local shooting sports community with a 380-acre site featuring trap, skeet, five stand, and two sporting clays fields, as well as a 9,000-square-foot clubhouse, which all is available to local shooters, and soon, an archery range. Check it out at TucsonTrapAndSkeet.com or take a drive out west of town and see it for yourself. New members or single-day use, welcome.
That was sure a good fight, stranger. No guy's gonna get away with slugging me. Watch me get him.
Look out!
Now listen, Roughneck. There ain't room enough for both of us in this town. And I don't aim to leave. You better clear out by sundown.
This is the Voices of the West.
Left my gal in Chickasha, left that gal and went away. In my heart is a melody, and the darned old song keeps telling me, get right back to Chickasha, to that gal and never stray
there. We are back on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts in Los Angeles, our guest Dave Kennedy out of Fort Smith, Arkansas, with the United States Marshals Museum. MarshallsMuseum.org. Visit the website and enjoy it. And, hey, even donate if you can. We are rapidly running out. We are rapidly running out of time here, and we have not gotten to all of the goodies that we really wanted to get to you. So that means we have to have you back.
I would love to be back on here at some point. As you can tell, I absolutely hate telling any of my stories.
I hear you. All right.
Todd, you can have me here back whenever you want.
All right. Todd Roberts has the last question of the evening, afternoon.
Of the day. Yes, I do, and I'm glad to deliver it. But before I deliver it, let me just tell you, David, when you do come back on, you are going to be talking about your previous history up in at the other museum.
Cody.
Was that the Cody?
Yeah.
Yep. The Buffalo Bill. Okay. Yep. I was at the Cody Firearms Museum. Yes, sir.
Fabulous. Okay, well, we got a lot more to talk about. So, here we go, David. No pressure, because there's plenty, and just realize it is crushing. Your favorite...
And we are judgmental.
Yes, oh yeah, we're absolutely judgmental when we take no prisoners. Your favorite Western film or television show?
Oh, my favorite Western film or television show. It's kind of about a three-way tie. True Grit, the original.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I remember that one as a kid.
Obvious.
Silverado, just simply because that's the most Western movie of Western movies I think I've seen. They kind of went out of their way to do every single Western movie trope they could.
Yes.
And then Blazing Saddles, simply because as a Western, as a historian of the American West, I honestly believe that that's one of the most accurate histories of the American West.
Imagine
Absolutely.
That. Imagine that. How about favorite television marshal or movie marshal?
Favorite movie marshal, I would have to go with Tommy Lee Jones. I know it's a little bit modern.
Yeah.
But yes. He really just bats that one out of the park.
Yep.
But for television marshals, I think I'd have to go back to Gunsmoke.
Okay.
It just really, honestly, I remember sitting there watching Gunsmoke every week, just sitting there with my dad and watching Gunsmoke.
Yep.
Favorite comic book marshal?
Hate to say it, but I have none.
It's hard to think of one, really.
Yeah, Red Ryder, man.
Oh yeah, Red Ryder. I know they're out there.
Yeah.
And there was, though, for a very long time, there was a comic strip, and I'm trying to remember the name of the guy. The artist was from up in Montana, and
Ricochet. He was up there from the big lake up there.
Yeah, but the character that was it was a western comic strip, like a daily or weekly comic strip that was a western, and the character in there was a deputy U.S. marshal.
All right.
Yeah, I think Ricochet was doing.
I've got one for you to check out. I don't know how old your kids are, but I think they'd enjoy it. It's usually found on the Disney Channel. You probably can find it on the YouTube as well. Sheriff Callie and Friends.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Sheriff Callie and Friends. Callie is the sheriff. She's a cat, calico cat.
Oh!
And her deputy is Peck. He's a cactus. No, that's Toby. He's a cactus. Peck is a bird. And she just goes and saves nice and friendly corners with their town.
And I would have to tell you at this point that my children are a little bit old for that. They are just finished up their freshman and junior years in college.
Hey, I watch it, and I'm an adult well past that.
That's because as adults, we can watch whatever we want.
Thank you so much.
In a very unadult way.
Yeah, no, it's a hoot to watch, and because we love calico cats, that's why we like that one. Okay, because we like cats. It's not like my daughter. That's it for this time. Dave, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And you will be invited back, I guarantee it. All right?
I look forward to it, gentlemen.
All right. Thank you so much.
That's it.
Thank you, David.
79. ADOs, all U.S. Marshals out there, and stay safe, darn it.
By golly. Thanks for listening, folks.
Thanks for listening to Emil Franzing's Voices of the West.